Except it's not really decoration. You notice how they look at you when you walk up. A sweep of the eyes, an inspection of your wrists or neck or ankles. A frown as you are found wanting. The impractical cloth has one very practical use. It is the marker of a new tribe in the process of being born. A tribe to which you do not belong. Not a problem, yet. You ask them what happened in the north. You know, but being aware of a geological event and knowing what that event means in the real human sense are two very different things. They tell you, once you've held up your hands and made it clear, you offer no visible threat. I was on my way home from a concert, says one of the younger women, who does not introduce herself, but should be, if she is not already, a breeder. She's what sunset women are supposed to look like, tall and strong and bronze and almost offensively healthy, with nice even features and wide hips, all of it crowned with a shock of gray ash-blow hair that's almost like a pelt about her shoulders. She jerks her head toward the young man, who lowers his gaze demurely. Just as pretty. Probably a breeder too, though a bit on the scrawny side. Well, he'll beef up if he's got five women to service for his keep. He was playing at the improvisation hall on Shemshana Street. This was in Levid. The music was so beautiful. She trails off. And for a moment you see her detach from the here and now. You know, Alebid was a mid-sized city com known for its art scene. Then she snaps back, because of course she is a good Sunzed girl, and Sunzeds hold little truck with daydreamers. She continues, "We saw something sort of tear off to the north, along the horizon, I mean. We could see this red light flare up at one point, then it spread off to the east and west. I couldn't tell how far away, but we could see it reflected on the underside of the clouds." She's drifting again, but remembering something terrible this time, and so her face is hard and grim and angry. That's more socially acceptable than nostalgia. "It spread fast. We were just standing in the street watching it grow and trying to figure out what we were seeing and assessing when the ground started to shake. Then something, a cloud, obscured the red, and we realized it was coming toward us. It had not been a pyroclastic cloud, you know, or she wouldn't be here talking to you. Just an ash storm, then. Alebid is well south of Eumenes. All they got was the dregs of whatever more northerly calms did. And that's good, because those dregs alone almost broke the much further south to Remo. By rights, Alebid should have been pebbles. An origin saved this girl, you suspect. Yes, there's a node station near Alebid. Or there was. Everything was still standing, she says, confirming your guess. But the ash that followed, no one could breathe. The ash was getting in people's mouths, into their lungs, turning into cement. I tied my blouse around my face. It was made of the same stuff as a mask. That's the only thing that saved me, us. She glances at her young man, and you realize the scrap around his wrist is part of what used to be a woman's garment by the color. It was evening. After a beautiful day, it's not like anybody had their runny sacks with them. Silence falls. This time, everyone in the group lets it go on and drifts with her for a moment. The memory's just that bad. You remember, too, that not many equatorials even have runny sacks. The nodes have been more than enough to keep the biggest cities safe for centuries. So we ran. The woman concludes abruptly with a sigh. And we haven't stopped. You thank them for the information and leave before they can ask questions in return. As the days pass, you hear other similar stories, and you notice that none of the equatorials you meet are from Eumenes or any comms from the same approximate latitude. Alebid is as far north as the survivors run. Doesn't matter, though. You're not going north. And no matter how much it bothers you, what's happened, what it means, you know better than to dwell too much on it. Your head's crowded enough with ugly memories. So you and your companions keep going through the gray days and ruddy nights, and all that really concerns you is keeping your canteen filled and your food stores topped up, and replacing your shoes when they start to wear thin. Doing all this is easy for now, because people are still hoping this will be just a brief season. A year without a summer, or two, or three. That's how most seasons go, and comms that remain willing to trade during such times, profiting off others' poor planning, generally come out of it wealthy. You know better. This season will be much, much longer than anyone could have planned for. But that won't stop you from taking advantage of their misconception. Now and again, you stop at comms you pass on the road, some of them huge and sprawling, with granite walls that loom overhead. Some of them protected merely by fence wire, sharpened sticks, and poorly armed strongbacks. The prices are beginning to go strange. One comm will take currency, and you use up nearly all of yours buying Hoa his own bedroll. The next won't take currency at all. But they will take useful tools, and you've got one of Jija's old napping hammers at the bottom of your bag. That buys you a couple weeks' worth of cash bread and 3 jars of sweet nut paste. You share the food out among the three of you, because that's important. Stone Lore's full of admonitions against hoarding within a group. And you are a group by now, whether you want to admit it or not. Hoa does his part, staying up most of the night to keep watch. He doesn't sleep much, or eat anything. But after a while you try not to notice that, the same way you try not to think about him turning a kukuza into stone. Tonki doesn't like approaching comms. Even though with fresh clothing and no worse than usual body odor, she can pass for just another displaced person rather than a calmless. So that part's on you. Still, Tonki helps where she can. When your boots wear out and the calm you've approached won't take anything you offer, Tonki surprises you by holding out a compass. Compasses are priceless. With the sky clouded over and no visibility through the ashfall. You ought to be able to get 10 pairs of boots for it. But the woman doing the comms trading has you over a barrel, and she knows it. So you get only 2 pairs of boots, one for you and another for Hoa, since his are already starting to look worn. Tonki, who has her own spare boots dangling from her pack, dismisses the price when you complain about it later. There are other ways to find our way, she says. And then she stares at you in a way that makes you uneasy. You don't think she knows you're a Raga. But who can really say with her? The miles roll on. The road forks often because there are a lot of big comms in this part of the Midlats. And also because the Imperial Road intersects comm roads and cow paths. Rivers and old metal tracks that were used for transportation in some way or another, by some ancient dead sieve or another. These intersections are why they put Imperial roads where they do. Roads have always been the lifeblood of old Sansa. Unfortunately, that means it's easy to get lost if you don't know where you're going. Or if you don't have a compass or a map or a sign saying, Philicidal Fathers this way. The boy is your savior. You're willing to believe that he can somehow sense Nasun, because for a while he's better than a compass, pointing unerringly in the direction that you should go whenever you reach a crossroads. For the most part, you follow the Imperial Road. This one is Yumanus Kedekur, though Kedekur's all the way in the Antarctics, and you pray you won't have to go that far. At one point, Hoa takes you down a calm road that cuts between Imperial segments and probably saves you a lot of time. especially if Jija just stayed on the main roads the whole way. The shortcut is a problem because the Khan that built it is bristling with well-armed strongbacks who shout and fire crossbow warning shots when they see you. They do not open their gates to trade. You feel their sights on you long after you've passed by. When the road meanders away from due south, though, Hoa's less certain. When you ask, he says that he knows the direction in which Nasun is traveling, but he cannot sense the specific route she and Jija took. He can only point out the path that's most likely to get you there. As the weeks pass, he begins to have trouble with even that. You stand with Hoa at one crossroads for a full 5 minutes while he chews his lip, until finally you ask him what's wrong. There are a lot of you in one place now, he says uneasily, and you change the subject quickly, because if Tonki doesn't know what you are, then she will after a conversation like that. A lot of you, though. People? No, that doesn't make sense. Ragas. Gathering together. That makes even less sense. The fulcrum died with Eumenes. There are satellite fulcrums in Arctic, far north, past the now impassable central latitude of the continent, and Antarctica. But you're months away from the latter. Any origins left on the roads now are people like her, hiding what they are and trying to survive same as the rest. It wouldn't make sense for them to gather into a group. That would increase the chance of discovery. At the crossroads, Hoa picks a path. And you follow, but you can tell by the frown on his face that it's a guess. It's nearby, Hoa finally tells you, one night while you're eating cash bread and nut paste, and trying not to wish it was something better. You're starting to crave fresh vegetables. But those are going to be in short supply very soon if they aren't already. So you try to ignore the craving. Tonki is off somewhere, probably shaving. She's run out of something in the past few days. Some biomest potion she keeps in her pack, and tries not to let you see her drinking, even though you don't care. And she's been sprouting beard stubble every few days because of the lack. It's made her irritable. The place with all the origins, Hoa continues. I can't find anything past them. They're like little lights. It's easy to see just one by itself, Nasun. But together they make one very bright light, and she passed close to it or through it. Now I can't... He seems to grope for the words. There are no words for some things. I can't... Sess, you suggest. He frowns. No, that isn't what I do. You decide not to ask what he does. I can't know anything else. The bright light keeps me from focusing on any little light. How many, you leave out the word in case Tonki is coming back, are there? I can't tell. More than one, less than a town. But more are heading there. This worries you. They can't all be chasing stolen daughters and murderous husbands. Why? How do they know to go there? I don't know. Well, that's helpful. All you know for sure is that Jija headed south. But south covers a lot of territory, more than a third of the continent. Thousands of comms, tens of thousands of square miles. Where's he going? You don't know. What if he turns east or west? What if he stops? There's a notion. Could they have stopped there, Jija and Nasun, in that place? I don't know. They went that way, though. I didn't lose them until here. So you wait till Tonki comes back, and you tell her where you're going. You don't tell her why, and she doesn't ask. You don't tell her what you're going into, either, because really, you don't know. Maybe someone's trying to build a new fulcrum. Maybe there was a memo. Regardless, it's good to have a clear destination again. You ignore the feeling of unease as you start down the road that, hopefully, Nasun traveled. Judge all by their usefulness. The leaders and the hearty, the fecund and the crafty, the wise and the deadly. And a few strong backs to guard them all. From Tablet 1, On Survival, Verse 9. 14. Cyanite breaks her toys. Remain at location. Await instructions, reads the telegram from Eumenes. Cyanite offers this to Alabaster wordlessly, and he glances at it and laughs.
Well, well. I'm beginning to think you've just earned yourself another ring, Cyanite Origin. Or a death sentence. I suppose we'll see when we get back.
They're in their room at the Season's End Inn, naked after their usual evening fuck. Cyanite gets up, naked and restless and annoyed, to pace around the room's confines. It's a smaller room than the one they had a week ago, since their contract with Alia is now fulfilled, and the Calm will no longer pay for their boarding. When we get back, she glares at him as she paces. He is completely relaxed, a long-boned, positive space against the bed's negative whiteness in the dim evening light. She cannot help thinking of the garnet obelisk when she looks at him. He is just as should not be, just as not quite real, just as frustrating. She cannot understand why he's not upset. What is this remain at location bullshit? Why won't they let us come back? He tisks at her.
Language? You were such a proper thing back at the Fulcrum. What happened?
I met you. Answer the question.
Maybe they want to give us a vacation.
Alabaster yawns and leans over to take a piece of fruit from the bag on the nightstand. They've been buying their own food for the past week. At least he's eating without being reminded now. Boredom is good for him.
What does it matter whether we waste our time here or on the road back to Eumenes, Cyan? At least here, we can be comfortable. Come back to bed.
She bares her teeth at him. No. He sighs.
To rest. We've done our duty for the night.
Earth fires. Do you want me to leave for a while so you can masturbate? Will that put you in a better mood?
It would, actually. But she won't admit that to him.
She does come back to the bed, finally, for lack of anything better to do. He hands her an orange slice, which she accepts, because they're her favorite fruit and they're cheap here. There's a lot to be said for living in a coaster calm. She's thought more than once since coming here. Mild weather, good food, low cost of living, meeting people from every land and region as they flow through the port for travel and trade. And the ocean is a beautiful, entrancing thing. She has stood at the window and stared out at it for hours. If not for the tendency of coaster calms to be wiped off the map every few years by tsunami, well,
I just don't understand, she says, for what feels like the 10,000th time.
Bastard's probably getting tired of her complaining, but she's got nothing else to do, so he'll have to endure it.
Is this some kind of punishment? Was I not supposed to find a giant floating whatever the rust hidden at the bottom of a harbor during a routine coral clearing job?
She throws up her hands. As if anyone could have anticipated that.
Most likely, Alabaster says. They want you on hand for whenever the geomasts arrive, in case there's more potential business for the Fulcrum in it.
He said this before, and she knows it's probably true. Geomasts have already been converging on the city, in fact, and archaeomasts and lorists and biomasts, and even a few doctors who are concerned about the effect that an obelisk so close will have on Alia's populace.
And the charlatans and cranks have come too, of course. Metallurists and astronomists and other junk science practitioners. Anyone with a bit of training or a hobby, from every calm in the Quartant and neighboring ones. The only reason Cyanide and Alabaster have even gotten a room is that they're the ones who discovered the thing, and because they got in early. Otherwise, every inn and lodging house in the Quartant is full to brimming. No one's really cared about the damn obelisks before now. Then again, no one's ever seen one hovering so close, clearly visible, and stuffed with a dead stone eater above a major population center. But beyond interviewing Cyanide for her perspective on the raising of the obelisk, she's already starting to wince every time a stranger is introduced to her as some fool, innovator, wherever. The Mests haven't wanted anything from her. Which is good, since she's not authorized to negotiate on behalf of the Fulcrum. Alabaster might be, but she doesn't want him bargaining with anyone for her services. She doesn't think he'd intentionally sign her up for anything she doesn't want. He's not a complete ass. It's just the principle of the thing. And worse, she doesn't quite believe Alabaster. The politics of being left here don't make sense. The Fulcrum should want her back in the Equatorials, where she can be interviewed at 7th by Imperial scholars, and where the seniors can control how much the Mests have to pay for access to her. They should want to interview her themselves and better understand that strange power she's now felt 3 times, and which she finally understands is somehow coming from obelisks. And the Guardians should want to talk to her. They always have their own secrets to keep. It disturbs her most of all that they've shown no interest. Alabaster has warned her not to talk about this part of it. No one needs to know that you can connect to the obelisks, he said, the day after the incident. He was still weak then, barely able to get out of bed after his poisoning. Turns out, he'd been too orogenically exhausted to do anything when she raised the obelisk, despite her boasting to Asael about his long-distance skill. Yet weak as he was, he'd grabbed her hand and gripped it hard to make sure she listened. Tell them you just tried to shift the strata and the thing popped up on its own, like a cork underwater. Even our own people will believe that. It's just another dead civ artifact that doesn't make any sense. Nobody will question you about it if you don't give them a reason to. So don't talk about it. Not even to me. Which, of course, makes her want to talk about it even more. But the one time she tried after Baster recovered, he glared at her and said nothing, until she finally took the hint and went to go do something else. And that pisses her off more than anything else. I'm going for a walk, she says finally and gets to her feet. Okay, says Alabaster, stretching and getting up. She hears his joints pop. I'll go with you. I didn't ask for company. No, you didn't. He's smiling at her again, but in that hard-edged way she's beginning to hate. But if you're going out alone, at night, in a strange calm, where someone's already tried to kill one of us, then you're rusting well going to have company. At this, Cyanide flinches. Oh, but that's the other subject they can't talk about. Not because Alabaster's forbidden it, but because neither of them knows enough to do more than speculate. Cyanide wants to believe that the simplest explanation is the most likely. Someone in the kitchen was incompetent. Alabaster has pointed out the flaw in this, however. No one else at the inn or in the city has gotten sick. Cyanide thinks there might be a simple explanation for this, too. Asael told the kitchen workers to contaminate only Alabaster's food. That's the kind of thing angry leaders tend to do, at least in all the stories about them, which abound with poisonings and convoluted indirect viciousness. Cyan prefers stories about resistance overcoming impossible odds, or breeders saving lives through clever political marriages and strategic reproduction, or strong backs tackling their problems with good, honest violence. Alabaster, being Alabaster, seems to think there was more to his near-death brush, and Cyanite doesn't want to admit that he might be right. "Fine, then," she says, and gets dressed. It's a pleasant evening. The sun's just setting as they walk down a sloping avenue that leads toward the harbor. Their shadows stretch long before them, and the buildings of Alia, which are mostly stuccoed sandy pale in color, briefly bloom with deeper jewel tones of red and violet and gold. The avenue they're on intersects a meandering side street that ends at a small cove off the harbor's busier area. When they stop here to take in the view, Cyan can see a group of the Calm's adolescents playing and laughing along the black sand beach. They're all lean and brown and healthy and obviously happy. Cyan finds herself staring and wondering if that is what it's like to grow up natural. Then the obelisk, which is easily visible at the end of the avenue they're standing on, where the thing hovers perhaps 10 or 15 feet above the harbor waves, emits another of the low, barely perceptible pulses that it's been spitting out since Cyan raised it. And that makes her forget about the kids. "Something's wrong with that thing," Alabaster says, very softly. Cyanite looks at him, annoyed and on the brink of saying, "What, now you want to talk about it?" when she notices that he's not looking at it. He's scuffing the ground with one foot, his hands in his pockets, appearing... Oh. Cyan almost laughs, appearing for the moment like a bashful young man who's about to suggest something naughty to his pretty female companion. The facts that he is not young or bashful, and that it doesn't matter if she's pretty or he's naughty because they're already fucking aside. A casual observer would not realize he was paying any attention to the obelisk. Which abruptly makes Cyanite realize, no one senses its pulse but them. The pulse is not a pulse, exactly. It's not brief or rhythmic. More a momentary throb that she cesses now and again, at random and ominously like a toothache. But if the other people of the Calm had cessed that last one, they wouldn't be laughing and playing and winding down comfortably at the end of a long golden day. They would all be out here watching this massive looming thing, to which Cyanide is increasingly beginning to apply the adjective dangerous in her head. Cyan takes a clue from Baster, and reaches for his arm, cuddling close as if she actually likes him. She keeps her voice to a murmur, even though she has no clue who or what he's trying to conceal the conversation from. There are people out on the street as the city's business day winds down, but nobody's nearby, or paying attention to them, for that matter. "I keep waiting for it to rise, like the others. Because it's hanging far, far too close to the ground, or the water's surface, as it were. Every other obelisk Cyan has ever seen, including the amethyst that saved Alabaster's life, and which is still drifting a few miles offshore, floats amid the lowest layer of clouds or higher. It's listing to one side, too, like it's barely able to stay up at all. What?" And she cannot help looking up at it, though Baster immediately squeezes her arm to make her look away again. But that brief glimpse was enough to confirm what he said. The obelisk is indeed listing, just a little, its top end tilted toward the south. It must wobble very slowly as it turns. The slant is so slight that she wouldn't have noticed it at all if they hadn't been standing on a street, surrounded by straight walled buildings. Now she can't unsee it. "Let's go this way," she suggests, They've lingered here too long. Alabaster obviously agrees, and they start down the side street to the cove, strolling casually.
It's why they're keeping us here.
Sion's not paying attention to him when he says this. In spite of herself, she's distracted by the beauty of the sunset and the long, elegant streets of the calm itself. And another couple passing on the sidewalk. The taller woman nods to them, even though both Sion and Baster are wearing their black uniforms. It's strange, that little gesture. And nice. Humanus is a marvel of human achievement, the pinnacle of ingenuity and engineering. If it lasts a dozen seasons, this paltry little coaster calm will never even come close to matching it. But in Humanus, no one would ever have deigned to nod to a Raga, no matter how pleasant the day. Then Alabaster's last words penetrate her ruminations. What? He keeps his pace easy, matching hers despite his naturally longer gait.
We can't talk in the room. It's risky even to talk out here. But you wanted to know why they're keeping us here, telling us not to come back. That's why. That obelisk is failing.
That much is obvious, but what's that got to do with us?
You raised it.
She scowls before she remembers to school her expression. It raised itself. I just moved all the crap that was holding it down and maybe woke it up. That her mind insists it was sleeping before is not something she's willing to question too deeply.
And that's more control over an obelisk than anyone has ever managed in nearly 3,000 years of imperial history.
Baster shrugs a little.
If I were a jumped-up little five-ring pedant reading a telegram about this, it's what I'd think, and it's how I'd react. By trying to control the person who can control that.
His eyes flick toward the obelisk.
But it's not the jumped-up pedants at the fulcrum we have to worry about.
Sion doesn't know what the rust he's on about. It isn't that his words don't ring true. She can completely imagine someone like Feldspar pulling something like this. But why? To reassure the local population? By keeping a ten-ringer on hand? The only people who know Baster's here are a bunch of bureaucrats who are probably too busy dealing with the sudden influx of mests and tourists to care.
To be able to do something. Should the obelisk suddenly do something?
That makes no sense. And who else is she supposed to worry about, unless... She frowns. You said something earlier. Something about connecting to an obelisk? What did that mean? And you did something that night.
She throws an uneasy look at him, but he doesn't glare at her this time. He's gazing down at the cove, as if entranced by the view. But his eyes are sharp and serious.
He knows what she's talking about. She hesitates a moment more, then says, "You can do something with those things, can't you?"
Oh, Earth, she's a fool.
You can control them.
Does the fulcrum know that?
No. And you don't know it either.
His dark eyes slide to hers for a moment, then away.
Why are you being so...
It's not even secretive. He's talking to her, but it's as if he suspects someone of listening to them somehow.
No one could hear us in the room.
And she nods pointedly toward a gaggle of children running past, one of them jostling Alabaster and apologizing. The street's narrow.
Apologizing? Really? You don't know that. The building's main support column is hole-hewn granite, didn't you notice? The foundation looks to be the same, if it sits directly on the bedrock.
His expression grows momentarily uneasy, and then he blanks his face.
What's that got to do with...
And then she understands. Oh. Oh, but no, that can't be right.
You're saying someone could hear us through the walls? Through the stone itself?
She's never heard of anything like that. It makes sense, of course, but it's how orogeny works. When Sion is anchored in the earth, she can sense not only the stone that her awareness is tied to, but anything that touches it. Even if she can't perceive the thing itself as with the obelisk. Still, to feel not just tectonic vibrations, but sound? It can't be true. She's never heard of a Raga with that kind of fine sensitivity.
He looks at her directly for a long moment.
I can.
When she stares back, he sighs.
I always could. You can too, probably. It just isn't clear yet. It's just minute vibrations to you now. Around my 8th or 9th ring is when I started to distinguish patterns amid the vibrations. Details.
She shakes her head.
But you're the only 10-ringer.
Most of my children have the potential to wear 10 rings.
Cyanite flinches, suddenly remembering the dead child in the node station near Mehi.
Oh. The fulcrum controls all the node maintainers. What if they have some way to force those poor damaged children to listen and to spit back what they listened to, like some kind of living telegraph receivers?
Is that what he fears? Is the fulcrum like a spider, perching in Eumenes's heart and using the web of nodes to listen in on every conversation in the stillness?
But she is distracted from these speculations by something that niggles at the back of her mind. Something Alabaster just said. His damn influence, making her question all the assumptions she's grown up with.
Most of my children have the potential to wear 10 rings, he'd said. But there are no other 10 ringers in the fulcrum. Raga children are sent to the nodes only if they can't control themselves, aren't they?
Oh. No.
She decides not to mention this epiphany aloud. He pats her hand, perhaps play-acting again, perhaps really trying to soothe her. Of course he knows, probably better than she, what they've done to his children. Then he repeats,
"The seniors of the fulcrum aren't who we have to worry about."
Who else could he mean? The seniors are a mess, granted. Sion keeps an eye on their politics because one day she'll be among them, and it's important to understand who holds power and who only looks like they do. There are at least a dozen factions, along with the usual rogues, brown-nosers and idealists, and those who would glass-knife their own mothers to get ahead. But all at once, it occurs to Sionite to consider who they answer to. The Guardians. Because no one would really trust a group of filthy Ragas to manage their own affairs, any more than Shemshenna would have trusted Missalem. No one in the Fulcrum talks about the Guardians' politics, probably because no one in the Fulcrum understands them. The Guardians keep their own counsel, and they object to inquiries vehemently. Not for the first time, Sionite wonders, to whom do the Guardians answer? As Sion's considered this, they've reached the cove and stopped at its railed boardwalk. The avenue ends here, its cobbles vanishing beneath a drift of sand, and then the raised wooden walkway. Not far off, there's a different sandy beach from the one they saw earlier. Children run up and down the boardwalk steps, squealing in play. And beyond them, Sion can see a gaggle of old women wading nude in the harbor's waters. She notices the man who sits on the railing a few feet down from where they stand, only because he's shirtless. And because he's looking at them. The former gets her attention for a moment. Then she's polite and looks away, because Alabaster's not much to look at, and it's been a while since she had sex she actually enjoyed. The latter is something she would ignore ordinarily, because in Humaness, she gets stared at by strangers all the time. But she's standing at the railing with Baster, relaxed and more comfortable than she's been in a while, listening to the children play. It's hard to keep her mind on the cryptic stuff they're discussing. The politics of Humaness seem so very far from here, mysterious but unimportant and untouchable, like an obelisk. But, she notices belatedly that Baster has gone stiff beside her, and although his face is turned toward the beach and the children, she can tell that he's not paying attention to them. That is when it finally occurs to her that people in Alia don't stare, not even at a couple of black jackets out for an evening stroll. Asael aside, most of the people she's met in this calm are too well-mannered for something like that. So she looks back at the man on the railing. He smiles at her, which is kind of nice. He's older, maybe by 10 years or so, and he's got a gorgeous body. Broad shoulders, elegant deltoids under flawless skin, a perfectly tapered waist, burgundy pants, and the shirt that hangs over the railing beside him, which he has ostensibly taken off in order to soak up some of the sunlight, is also burgundy. Only belatedly does she notice the peculiar familiar buzz at the back of her sesapine that warns of a guardian's presence.
"Yours?" asks Alabaster.
Cyanite licks her lips. "I was hoping he was yours."
"No."
And then Alabaster makes a show of stepping forward to rest his hands against the railing, bowing his head, as if he means to lean on it and stretch his shoulders.
"Don't let him touch you with his bare skin."
This is a whisper. She barely catches it. And then Alabaster straightens and turns to the young man.
"Something on your mind, Guardian?"
The Guardian laughs softly and hops down from the railing. He's at least part coaster, all over brown and kinky-haired, a bit on the pale side, but aside from this, he fits right in among the citizens of Alia. Well, no, he blends in superficially. But there's that indefinable something about him that's in every Guardian Cyanite's had the misfortune to interact with. No one in Humaness ever mistakes a Guardian for an origin, or for a still, for that matter. There's just something different about them, and everyone notices.
"Yes, actually," the Guardian says. "Alabaster Tenring, Cyanite Fourring."
That alone makes Cyanite grind her teeth. She would prefer the generic origin, if she has to be called anything besides her name. Guardians, of course, understand perfectly well the difference between a four-ringer and a ten-ringer.
"I am Edki Guardian Warrant."
"My, but you've both been busy."
"As we should be,"
says Alabaster, and Cyanite cannot help looking at him in surprise. He's tensed in a way she's never seen. The cords of his neck taut, his hands splayed and...
ready? Ready for what?
She does not know why the word ready even occurred to her. At his sides.
"We've completed our assignment for the fulcrum, as you can see."
"Oh, indeed. A fine job."
Edki glances off then, almost casually toward that listing throbbing accident of an obelisk. Cyanite is watching his face, however. She sees the Guardian's smile vanish, as if it were never there. That can't be good.
"Would that you had done only the job you were told to do, however. Such a willful creature you are, Alabaster."
Cyanite scowls. Even here she is condescended to.
"I did this job, Guardian. Is there some problem with my work?"
The Guardian turns to look at her, in surprise, and that's when Cyanite realizes she's made a mistake. A big one, because his smile doesn't return.
"Did you know?"
Alabaster hisses, an evil earth? She feels it when he stabs his awareness into the strata, because it goes so unbelievably deep. The strength of him makes her whole body reverberate, not just her sesapine. She can't follow it. He's past her range in the span of a breath, easily piercing to the magma, even though it's miles down. And his control of all that pure earth energy is perfect. Amazing. He could shift a mountain with this easily. But why? The Guardian smiles suddenly.
Guardian Lachette sends her regards, Alabaster.
While Cyanide is still trying to parse this, and the fact that Alabaster is about to fight a guardian, Alabaster stiffens all over.
You found her?
Of course. We must talk of what you did to her. Soon.
Suddenly, Cyanide does not know when he drew it or where from. There is a black glass knife in his hand. Its blade is wide but ridiculously short, maybe only 2 inches in length. Barely enough to be called a knife at all. What the rust is he going to do with that? Pare our nails? And why is he drawing a weapon on 2 Imperial origins in the first place?
Guardian?
She tries. Maybe there's been some kind of The Guardian does something. Cyanide blinks, but the tableau is as before. She and Alabaster face Edki on a boardwalk stark with shadows and bloody sunset light, with children and old ladies playing beyond them. But something has changed. She's not sure what, until Alabaster makes a choking sound and lunges at her, knocking her to the ground a few feet away. How such a skinny man has the weight to throw her, Cyanide will never know. She hits the planks hard enough to jar the breath out of herself. Through a blur, she sees some of the children who had been playing nearby stop and stare. One of them laughs. Then she struggles up, furious, her mouth already opening to curse Alabaster to earth and back. But Alabaster's on the ground too, only a foot or two away. He's lying on his belly, his eyes fixed on her, and he's making a strange sound. Not much of one. His mouth's open wide, but the noise that comes out of it is more like the squeak of a child's toy or a metallurist's air bladder. And he's shivering all over. As if he can't move more than that, which doesn't make sense because nothing's wrong with him. Cyan's not sure what to think until belatedly she realizes. He's screaming. Why did you think I would aim at her? Edki is staring at Alabaster, and Cyanide shivers because the look on his face is gleeful. It is delighted. Even as Alabaster lies there shuddering helplessly, with the knife that Edki once held, now buried in the hollow of Alabaster's shoulder. Cyan stares at it, stunned that she missed it before. It stands out starkly even against the black of Baster's tunic.
You have always been a fool, Alabaster.
And there is a new glass knife in Edki's hand now. This one is long and viciously narrow. A chillingly familiar poniard.
Why?
Cyanide can't think. Her hands ache as she scrabbles backward along the boardwalk planks, trying to get to her feet and away all at once. Instinctively, she reaches for the earth beneath her, and that's when she finally realizes what the Guardian has done. Because there's nothing in her that can reach. She cannot cess the earth past a few feet below her hands and backside. Nothing but sand and salty dirt and earthworms. There is an unpleasant ringing ache in her sesapine when she tries to reach farther. It's like when she hits her elbow and shuts off all the sensation from there to the tips of her fingers, like that part of her mind has gone to sleep. It's tingling, coming back. But for now, there's nothing there. She's heard Grits whisper of this after lights out. All guardians are strange, but this is what makes them what they are. Somehow they can stop Orogeny with a flick of their will. And some of them are especially strange, specialized to be stranger than the rest. Some of them do not have origin charges and are never allowed near untrained children because they are dangerous merely by proximity. These guardians do nothing but track down the most powerful rogue origins, and when they find them, well, Cyanite never particularly wanted to know what they did before now. But it seems she's about to find out. Under fires. She's as numb to the earth as the most rust-brained elder. Is this what it's like for stills? Is this all they feel? She has envied their normalcy her whole life until now. But as Edki walks toward her with the poniard ready, there is a tightness around his eyes, a grim set to his mouth, which makes her think of how she feels when she's had a bad headache. This is what makes her blurt. Are you all right? She has no idea why she asks this. At this, Edki cocks his head. The smile returns to his face, gentle and surprised.
How kind you are. I'm fine, little one. Just fine.
But he's still coming at her. She scrambles backward again, tries to get to her feet again, tries again to reach for power, and fails in all three efforts. Even if she could succeed, though, he's a guardian. It's her duty to obey. It's her duty to die if he wills it. This is not right. Please, she says, desperate, wild with it. Please, we haven't done anything wrong. I don't understand.
You need not understand, he says, with perfect kindness. You need do only one thing.
And then he lunges, aiming the poniard at her chest. Later, she will understand the sequence of events. Later, she will realize everything occurred in the span of a gasp. For now, however, it is slow. The passage of time becomes meaningless. She is aware only of the glass knife, huge and sharp, its facets gleaming in the fading dusk. It seems to come at her gradually, gracefully, drawing out her duty-bound terror. This has never been right. She is aware only of the gritty wood beneath her fingers and the useless pittance of warmth and movement that is all she can sess beneath that. Can't shift much more than a pebble with that. She is aware of Alabaster, twitching because he is convulsing. How did she not realize this before? He is not in control of his own body. There is something about the glass knife in his shoulder that has rendered him helpless for all his power, and the look on his face is of helpless fear and agony. She becomes aware that she is angry, furious. Duty be damned. What this guardian is doing, what all guardians do, is not right. And then, she becomes aware of the obelisk. Alabaster, twitching harder, opens his mouth wider, his eyes fixing on hers despite the uncontrollability of the rest of his flesh. The fleeting memory of his warning rings in her mind. Though in that instant, she cannot recall the words. The knife is halfway to her heart. She is very, very aware of this. We are the gods in chains, and this is not rusting right. So she reaches again, not down, but up, not straight, but to the side. No! Alabaster is shaping his mouth to say, through his twitches. And the obelisk draws her into its shivering, jittering, blood-red light. She is falling up. She is being dragged up and in. She is completely out of control. Oh, Father Earth, Alabaster was right. This thing is too much for her. And she screams because she has forgotten that this obelisk is broken. It hurts as she grinds across the zone of damage, each of the cracks seaming through her and shattering her and splitting her into pieces until she stops, hovering and curled in agony amid the cracked redness. It isn't real. It cannot be real. She feels herself also lying on sandy wooden boards with fading sunlight on her skin. She does not feel the Guardian's glass knife, or at least not yet. But she is here, too, and she sees, though Sesapine are not eyes, and the sight is all in her imagination. The stone eater at the core of the obelisk floats before her. It's her first time being close to one. All the books say that stone eaters are neither male nor female, but this one resembles a slender young man formed of white-veined black marble, clothed in smooth robes of iridescent opal. It's his limbs, marbled and polished, splay as if frozen in mid-fall. His head is flung back, his hair loose and curling behind him in a splash of translucence. The cracks spread over his skin, and the stiff illusion of his clothing into him, through him. "Are you all right?" she wonders. And she has no idea why she wonders it, even as she herself cracks apart. His flesh is so terribly fissured. She wants to hold her breath lest she damage him further. But that is irrational, because she isn't here and this isn't real. She is on a street about to die. But this stone eater has been dead for an age of the world. The stone eater closes his mouth and opens his eyes and lowers his head to look at her. "I'm fine," he says. "Thank you for asking." And then the obelisk shatters. 15. You're among friends. You reach the place with all the origins, and it's not at all what you were expecting. It's abandoned, for one thing. It's not a calm, for another. Not in any real sense of the word. The road gets wider as you approach, flattening into the land until it vanishes completely near the middle of town. A lot of calms do this, get rid of the road to encourage travelers to stop and trade. But those calms usually have some place to trade in. And you can't see anything here that looks like a storefront or marketplace, or even an inn. Worse, it doesn't have a wall. Not a stone pile, not a wire fence, not even a few sharpened sticks jabbed into the ground around the town perimeter. There's nothing to separate this community from the land around it, which is forested and covered in scraggly underbrush that makes perfect cover for an attacking force. But in addition to the town's apparent abandonment and lack of a wall, there are other oddities. Lots of them, you notice, as you and the others look around. There aren't enough fields, for one. A calm that can hold a few hundred people, as this one seems to be able to do, should have more than the single, stripped, bare hectare of scraggly choya stalks that you noticed on the way in. It should have a bigger pasture than the small plot of dried-out green you see near the town center. You don't see a storehouse either, elevated or otherwise. Okay, maybe that's hidden. Lots of calms do that. But then you notice that all the buildings are in wildly varied styles. This one tall and city narrow. That one wide and flat to the ground like something from a warmer climate. Yet another that looks to be a sod-covered dome, half set into the earth like your old house in Terimo. There's a reason most comms pick a style and stick to it. Uniformity sends a visual message. It warns potential attackers that the comms members are equally unified in purpose and the willingness to defend themselves. This comms visual message is confused. Uncaring, maybe. Something you can't interpret. Something that makes you more nervous than if the calm had been teeming with hostile people instead. You and the others proceed warily, slowly through the empty streets of the town. Tonki's not even pretending to be at ease. She's got twin glass knives in her hands, stark and black-bladed. You don't know where she's been hiding them, although that skirt of hers could conceal an army.